And I'll now invite the rest of our panel up to the stage, our speakers, Richard, Julia, Juliet, to come and engage with us. Might sit in the middle. So thank you all very much, and please get those questions in on the SMS number, which is 0417987179. As I said earlier, I won't ignore you this time. And please remember to complete your presenter feedback form for this plenary session through the app. Now, I'm going to take a question from the text, and it's to Juliet. And actually, no, I'm going to start from the bottom, because I've been told that's how we have to do them. So this one's for Julia. How can the Institute help bring actuaries together to bring skill and capacity to the wicked problems challenge?
That's a wicked question in itself. Look, I think when we're tackling wicked problems, it's not just about actuaries working together, it's about actuaries working with other professions. So I think anything that we can do to encourage us to be able to talk about what we do. So the elevator pitch, I think, is really important. But some of the skills like, you know, listening, soft skills, I think that kind of training is really helpful when we're trying to make a difference and solve these issues, because it helps us to interact with other professions.
Richard, someone on the SMS wants you to further explain how driverless cars are going to be so disruptive. And I've heard it said that something like 25% of all jobs are going to disappear in Australia as a result of the driverless car.
Well, I think disappear is a dangerous word, but effectively
in freight,
there will be changes in work. Right? So I actually think it's a huge net positive for society. There will be far fewer mortalities, far less stress. Traffic will be largely eliminated because something like a third of cars in any urban CBD are looking for parking. So if you take away parking, it just effectively clogs up the unclogs the road.
The question actually specifically wanted to understand why there won't be as many cars and why you won't need a car park.
I mean, I'm not a scientist, but the serious work that's been done on this problem suggests that driverless cars, where we don't actually own a car, I go from my house to my office and I want to go at 8:45 in the morning and I want a comfortable car that's going to play Mozart and have light air conditioning. I'm going to put that on my phone, and at 8:45 there's going to be a vehicle that's going to arrive. I'm going to jump in. It's going to take me to my office. I'm going to jump out. So I don't have to park. I don't have to drive. I don't have to get stuck in traffic. Just the parking dynamic is very significant. Another dynamic that is very significant is the sheer reduction in accidents. As you all know, when there's an accident on the freeway, that is that's, you know, a recipe for traffic mayhem. And then the last thing is, these cars will communicate with each other. So they will know where the traffic hotspots are, and they will be constantly evaluating the quickest and least impacted route to where you are going. And so you'll have the kind of efficacy of shared knowledge. I think those are the kind of main three items which are going to lead to the reduction in traffic as a result of cars.
Thank you, Richard. Juliet, this is actually something you and I were talking about before this next question, and that is, where have you seen diverse recruitment work well for technical teams, and what do they do differently? So how is it? It is an interesting question, because it's easy to recruit a diverse team based on what they look like. Yeah. I'll get the Asian person, the person with a disability, the woman, and Bob's your uncle. But how do you recruit a team that has a diversity of points of view or whatever and thinking?
Yeah. And so I guess it comes down to redefining what the job is that the person is being asked to do. I know that McKinsey years ago kind of redesigned what consultants were being asked to do and started opening it up from people who had been, you know, getting great marks in business or economics or something like that, to then say, well, maybe it could be people from industry as well who had industry experience. So they started redefining what would be a great client experience is someone who not only understands how you do the economics or the numbers side of developing a strategy, but also how you have the industry expertise. So they were one of the first to put that together. But I think that the fundamental question is, what is it that the job that's being done? And diversity of thinking is not a substitute for having basic level technical capability capability. I don't want a surgeon operating on me that doesn't know how to use a needle, right? So, you know, there are some basic things there. But in and beyond that, the people that are standing around me while I'm on the operating, just to keep that analogy going, on the operating table, you know, would have a multidisciplinary approach to my care on the table, my care before I got to the table, my care after the table, so taking a more holistic approach to it. But starting with what is the job you're trying to do and expanding it outwards.
Have you seen evidence in studies and research that indicates a more diverse team is more profitable for an organisation?
Yeah, there's lots and lots and lots of studies that go to that point. But the person that I follow the most is this guy called Professor Scott Page out of Michigan University. And he was really smart. What he did is he does a lot of computational modelling, and he put together teams of people who had one or two sort of similarities in the way that they solve problems. And then he put together sort of three elements of diversity, five elements of diversity, nine elements of diversity. And what he found each time, it's called the diversity trumps homogeneity theorem, is that if you have a group of people together who are of average intelligence but diverse in the way they approach a problem, then they will trump those who are all the same.
An unfortunate term.
But I know, he'll have to change it now. He's writing a second book right now, so I'll ask him what it is now. But they will, what is another word for Trump? Do better than those group of people who are effectively monocultural. And what he worked out, it's a curvilinear relationship. And so it's not that you want to have endless diversity. Actually, it caps out before you get to nine different elements. So I found there was, you needed six different ways of thinking about things. He said you need between five and eight different ways of thinking about. But if you have nine, you get to 90% accuracy. So not all diversity is good diversity. It has to be within a confine. That was a long answer, wasn't it?
No, but it was good. Renee, do you have any idea how we might improve financial literacy in this country? Because I think it's probably more than one in ten.
Yeah. So I guess
the one in ten figure about not understanding financial products.
Yeah.
I think you're being kind.
I think our philosophy is that particularly for people on low incomes, you would actually be amazed at how financially literate they are. So when it comes to understanding a household budget and how they spend their money, they know exactly where the dollars go. And we often will see clients who have different jars, something for rent, something for utilities, something for, you know, the credit card, and that's how they manage their money. I think where financial literacy comes into it and needs to be improved is around some of the more complex products in the market. So, for example, insurance. We know it's really hard to compare products when it comes to insurance policies, and people don't read too long, don't read product disclosure PDS statements. So if we can think about ways to make products really simple for people to understand, I think we will see them picking it up a lot more. So, you know, we'd love to see an insurance company develop a PDS that's four pages long. I don't know if it can be done, but...
Four?
Four is long, but even in the product that we've worked on with Suncorp, you know, you're looking at a PDS that's over 100 pages long and people do not read these documents. So, yeah.
I bet people in this room don't read those.
I don't know. Maybe they write them.
yeah, it's a challenge.
It is, yeah.
Richard, your work with Head Over Heels. Tell us a bit about that and how you got involved.
So Heads Over Heels is a not-for-profit organisation based in Sydney that's actually launching in Melbourne on Thursday night, which helps high-powered and high-potential women entrepreneurs scale their businesses. And the model is really simple. The model is these entrepreneurs come and present to a group of well-connected individuals and effectively make pleas, right? And the pleas might be, I need access to somebody at Woolworths who can assist me to get my product on, you know, in their stores. And invariably there will be somebody in the connector group who goes, oh, I'm having dinner with the chairman tomorrow night. I'll put in a pitch for you. And when you're an entrepreneur and you get in through the front door, the speed at which you can get things done is just exponentially enhanced. And there are numerous businesses in the portfolio that have had kind of game-changing introductions, both to potential customers, to capital, through this very simple method of networks. And the reason that it's important for women entrepreneurs is women actually start more than 50% of the small businesses in Australia, yet only 2% of the ones that scale are run by women. And so the thesis of Heads Over Heels is that is the network effect, and that most of the kind of corporate networks that are highly valuable are still embedded in the traditional male business community. So this organization assists break that down and share those networks of both men and women to these business, these emerging business leaders. And on a kind of personal level, I think of myself as an entrepreneur who's like wound up running a big financial institution. And it, you know, I actually much preferred the entrepreneur bit. So it gives me an opportunity to engage with entrepreneurs who are so passionate and enthusiastic about their business. So I get an enormous amount of satisfaction from it, you know, at a very kind of gut personal level.
Do you find that part of that puzzle or puzzling element of why women's businesses don't upscale in a way men's do, what role does unconscious or conscious bias play?
I think it plays an enormous role. And I've seen it in our organization. So when we first introduced, you know, diversity measurements in our organization, all the women leaders told me it's really easy to find capable women, and all the men told me it was impossible to. And I pretty quickly realized that there was something going on. It wasn't through lack of will. It was people instinctively are attracted to people who are like them. And so when you're interviewing and you hear someone use words that you would use or body language that you would share, you feel comfortable and you associate wisdom with that. And so I have required all of our managers to undergo subconscious bias training because I don't think you can solve the gender issue without solving that specific. It's one issue, but I think it's a non-negotiable. You have to address that issue if you want to solve the diversity issue in corporate life.
I'll just give a short anecdote from my own experience. When I went to Europe to be the correspondent, I happened to arrive in 2008 when Norway had just gone through their 40% mandated women on boards for publicly listed companies, and so every company had to be up to the 40% limit they had from 2004 to 2008 to get there or face a percentage of revenue penalty. So that certainly focused the minds of the boards. And once I got there in 2008, I interviewed, everyone got them, by the way, no one was fined, no company was fined, and everyone got to the 40% level. And I interviewed the politician who was most intractably opposed to it, male, in 2004, who had railed against it, given these soliloquies in the parliament about how this was going to end Norway and so on. And in 2008, I interviewed him and he had done a full 180 and decided it was the best thing the country had ever done. And I said, wow, what changed your mind in the past 4 years? And he said, I hadn't realised how chairmen recruited their boards until we underwent this exercise. And I said, well, what did you learn? And he said, well, they recruit from their golf club, their tennis club, their dinner party circle, and their friends. Mm-hmm. They recruited people who look like them. Mm-hmm. And he said, I didn't realise what I thought was merit. Of course, these are publicly listed companies with a responsibility to their shareholders. I thought, naively, they were being recruited on account of their skill base, etc., etc. But it was so much less scientific than that. And he realised that bias part of the equation. And I thought that was very powerful example of finding out, you know, the hard way that the men aren't looking for the women, so funny they don't find them. Renee, someone wants to know from you what you think is the next product that needs to be developed, I'm assuming, for low-income individuals and families.
There are so many products, I can't begin to tell you, but certainly something that is on our radar is you know, the increasing use of payday lenders and rent-to-buy organisations in Australia. We're seeing a lot of people on low incomes get into debt spirals from lending from organisations like Cash Converters, from Money3, from Nimble, you know, those rabbit ads on TV that my son sees watching, you know, Go on television, Channel 9's Go. They're grooming children for the future about how money works. So certainly the difference between a payday loan and a NILS loan is that NILS is not a cash loan. NILS is for your fridge, for your vacuum cleaner, for your TV, for your washing machine. It's not cash, and I think
So does the money go straight to the provider
of the supplier? That's right. And so there's definitely room in the market for a cash loan that is affordable for people on low incomes, that doesn't rip them off, that doesn't want them to see them get in trouble, because a lot of the revenue on these loans is actually made when people can't pay the loan back. So definitely around cash loans, there's a huge opportunity there, which we are looking at, and also insurance products. So having a chat with Richard earlier, we need some more tailored insurance products for this market. We want to see competition in the market. We believe that's really healthy. At the moment, there's really only the one car and contents product that is tailored for people on low incomes. We're seeing demand for pet insurance, for funeral insurance, for more options when it comes to contents and for car. So lots of opportunities there for companies to start thinking about how can they reach this market.
And actuaries.
That's right.
Julia, I was, during your presentation, curious to know how, as an actuary, you became involved in the social services space.
Yeah, good question. I've always been passionate about our community and helping our community. I've had various volunteer roles over the years as a breastfeeding counsellor when my children were babies, at Lifeline on the phones as well. So I've always had an interest in that space. There's always been a passion there. Being a young mum myself, understanding some of those challenges as well about what it's like to try and raise a family when you're very young and trying to have a career and pay the bills. So it was really just a convergence of the work that I was doing. And don't get me wrong, I think insurance is, you know, incredibly powerful and very, very important to the well-being of our society. But I think stepping down that level to the most vulnerable was just a really interesting space for me. So I was lucky enough to be able to be well known for the skills and experience that I did have that I was using in insurance, namely being able to manage teams and being able to manage projects and get things done. And so when an opportunity came up to manage a project in that space, I was working for a Big Four consulting firm at the time, I took the opportunity. So it's kind of just gone from there, because I think when you start to head towards the area that you're interested in and that you're passionate about, your career kind of takes shape, the planets align around that.
Do you have any advice for any of the actuaries in the room who might want to emulate your career path?
Yeah, I think two things. So one is, think differently about your career. You know, I think as actuaries, we work so hard to get through our actuarial exams, and our path through our education is, I think, a bit more fixed than other professions. We've got less diversity in terms of our options and subjects that we can study at university. So we find ourselves kind of almost jumping through hoops in a sense. You know, we've got to get good marks in Year 12, keep getting good marks at university, get through those awful Part 3 exams. And by that stage, we're kind of, you know, mid-20s or later, and our career has almost just been a series of hoops. And so then we start to look around and go, well, you know, what's the next job for me? Okay, now I want to be not just an actuarial analyst, I want to be a qualified actuary, or I want to be a manager or a senior manager. And we start to think about our careers as a linear extension of that very fixed education system that we've been a product of. So I think thinking differently about your career in terms of, I like Sheryl Sandberg's idea of a climbing frame. So, you know, taking sideways steps isn't necessarily a bad thing for your career if it means that you're learning some new things and getting to do some things that you're really interested in. So firstly, I think just thinking differently about what your career should look like and what that next role should be, whether it's a promotional, whether it's an interesting and useful sideways step. Yeah, I think that's the main one, but I think also just finding something that you're really passionate about, finding something, you know, Odette spoke this morning about how in 19 years of running Adara, she's, you know, she always gets up and is happy to go to work. So I think finding something that you're really interested in and really passionate about, and good things follow.
Thank you. I think this next question is really interesting. Someone's SMS'd a question asking how the panel copes with stress. What techniques you use to cope with high emotional stress? And so I'm going to put it out to all of you to answer. I might start with you, Julia.
Thanks. In some ways, the person that's being asked is the person least qualified to give the answer. In some ways, I feel like you should be asking my children or my husband for an answer on it, because they would say, not very well. I suppose I try and put a number of things in place, but I've just come off the back of, I had a week in London a week ago. Last week I was in Singapore, and today I'm in Melbourne. I'm based in Sydney. So I've had three different time zones in my body. So I suppose one of the ways of doing it is to, I focus a bit more on sleep, and so I didn't wake up till 11 a.m. Saturday morning and just let myself sleep. I've just finished reading Arianna Huffington's book on sleep, so I really feel sleep. I try and get a couple of mornings of exercise in as I can. I don't watch TV. Sorry. But
no, no, I don't watch TV either. Just because I'm in it doesn't mean I watch it.
So try and cut out the things that I think I can cut out and try and put in some of the things that are going to sustain me, and then I make sure I support myself with some really good, healthy relationships.
Good. Richard?
Yeah, so I think the key is to have a very clear sense in your own mind around what you value, and be pretty disciplined about not doing things which don't enrich either your soul or your values. So particularly when I had children, and I had a bunch of children in close succession, and that in combination with work put me, you know, under an enormous amount of physical strain, I just started making a rational decision in my mind what I was going to cut out of my life. And I just started, like, conscientiously saying goodbye to things. And once they were gone, it suddenly felt like a less stressful thing. Right? So I literally took my golf clubs and I put them in storage. And I said, you know, when my kids are at university, I might take it up again, but that's gone, right? And there were a whole bunch of things that, like that, that I did, which freed up the time that I needed. And then I think the last thing is, I do think it is really important for everybody to have a personal bucket. So I think of my life in, like, my work bucket, my family bucket, and then a very small little personal bucket. But it is, I do conscientiously have some time for me as often as I can. And for me, that's riding my bike or going for a walk or whatever it is. But I think of it in terms of, this is my personal bucket. So I'm going to maximize the kind of relaxation that I get from it and make no compromises in that time.
Thank you. Renee?
Look, I think the thing that most helps me to manage workload and life is having a flexible workplace. So, you know, the ability to come into work late because I'm doing school drop-off, but I'm going to finish later on in the night because that's the decision that I've made, and that allows me to juggle with my husband, you know, those sort of tasks that are traditionally the women's job, you know, I very much share it 50-50 with my partner. And, yeah, flexible policies like being able to work from home, being able to, you know, bring your child into work as well. Occasionally that happens.
That doesn't necessarily reduce your stress.
No, no. But often it entertains everybody else while I get some work done.
Increases everyone else's stress level.
No, they have a bit of fun, I think. But and the other thing, you know, being a not-for-profit organisation, we're always under-resourced. We always have a lot of big projects running at one time, so we do have huge workloads. And we often just stop, you know, everyone stops and connects back to why we're doing it. And that's what really, I think, gives us our energy, is going back to our purpose and, you know, reconnecting with the why. And it just, it gives me so much more energy every day.
Thank you.
Mm. It's an interesting question, isn't it? I think it's a wicked problem in itself, trying to solve our stress levels. And we all face this. I imagine this question's come about because we work in the human services space, and so there's more sort of, you know, upsetting things to see and be part of. When I was training to be on the phones for Lifeline, they taught us about self-care and how important self-care was, and just to make sure that we were building that in to our routines. And self-care looks, it's different for everyone. And we've heard some examples, even, you know, having workplace flexibility, or, you know, whether it's exercise or breathing or cup of tea, or I like to crochet. You know, whatever it is for you, and finding that thing that you find is quite relaxing, and just building
the personal bucket.
Building that in, and just making sure that you schedule it. Yeah, the personal bucket.
Mm. Emma, what about you?
I run. I run most mornings. Mm. Yeah. And I find it incredible.
Mm. Very meditative.
Yeah, it is. It's terrific.
Can I just add one thing on work flexibility? As part of our organisation's approach to gender diversity, a year ago we introduced an all roles flex, which means every role in the company is flexible as a starting point, unless it is defined as not flexible. Whereas historically, no role was flexible unless you got permission to have a flexible role. And, you know, when we first introduced this, the HR department kind of threw up their hands, and, you know, we run call centers. And it's incredible how the organization just adopted it. We've got 40% of the organization now on flex time. And staff retention's improved. It's had an enormous benefit to the organization, and particularly for working parents, right? And any working parent knows that, you know, it is so difficult to stick to a strict schedule because your children, they get sick. They have, you know, open days. They have, you know, concert recitals. And it is one of the things that we've done that I think, you know, has had the most profound impact on our organization. So I'm
and
a big believer in it.
Do you work flexibly as well?
I do work flexible, yeah. I have, I try
because
to
often
have
those programs are very determinant on the people at the top showing that it can be done and should be done.
Yeah, so I have blocked off Friday mornings now. So I basically said, Friday mornings I'm going to take my kids to school, I'm going to have a little bit of personal time, and I'm going to come at lunchtime. And that's kind of my week. Is not, doesn't always happen, but I have made that decision, yeah.
Yeah, well, my boss, the director of news at the ABC, told me that he, on this topic, he picks his kids up twice a week and so leaves work at four or something. And he said the women in his team actually thanked him for it, because it sent the signal to them that it was okay when they leave early and have to do that kind of parenting response, you know, engage in that parenting responsibility. We're only going to have time for a couple more, and I do think I want to ask this one of Renee, because I think it's one that probably a lot of us are pondering. How are those no-interest loans funded?
So we have a relationship with the National Australia Bank, and they provide the loan capital. So there's about $24 million in loan capital every year. And as I said, you know, 95% of that is repaid. So it's like it's community finance. It gets recycled once it's paid back.
But there's an opportunity cost for the bank.
There is, and that's a cost that they bear, which is, you know, part of their contribution to, you know, being a responsible large corporate in this country. We're also funded by a federal government, but we rely on volunteers. As I said, there's 1,500 volunteers that are delivering loans. They're trained to deliver loans in local communities.
Are they former bank managers, or
there's a lot of bank
finance sector workers?
Bank managers, accountants. When they retire, they go and do this. So it does heavily rely on volunteers as well.
Mm-hmm. And the last question, which I'll put out to all of you for a view on, is quotas, and whether you think gender quotas, but not only gender quotas. Why do we stop there? Why do we not look at ethnic quotas and other quotas in terms of, and I think specifically we're probably talking about leadership roles in an organisation. What's your view, Julia, on the use of quotas?
Yeah, it's a very difficult one, isn't it? And I know there's schools of thought for and against quotas. I do think we need a structured approach to getting some gender balance in the workplace. And in my view, I've always said that we won't have gender equality at work until we have it at home. So more acceptance of stay-at-home dads, more equal partnering, parenting at home. You know, if we can get that right, then I think it's going to make it easier for us to do things in the workplace. Maybe some others can comment on the workplace.
How do you think we are going to get that balance right at home?
Well, I think there's cultural issues around it. So, you know, I have four children. My husband's a stay-at-home dad, and there's no way I could have had the career I've had if it wasn't for him at home, because of the world that we work in. And I've had a lot of flexibility. I've been very lucky to have managers who have supported that. But even still, you know, it's a huge juggle having two parents working full-time. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of challenges even in having that set up in place, and certainly challenges for my husband being in that minority of not having, you know, having some suspicious-looking women kind of going, why doesn't your husband work? Or, you know, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to let that child go to a play date over at the Lessing household because, you know, Steve's at home. So, you know, I think there's cultural issues that we all, in the same way that we've got unconscious bias and issues in the workplace, we've got the same sorts of stereotypes and predetermined ideas in the home as well. But I think we need to kind of get those both working together if we're going to tackle this.
It's interesting because for a period, my husband stayed home, and I remember going to a dinner party once where there were some women around the table who were PhDs and, you know, incredibly bright barristers and board directors and so on who were at that moment in time at home with their children. Mm. And a bloke asked my husband, who has no tertiary qualification, is a tradesman or was a tradesman before he was looking after the kids and so on. All the focus was on him. When are you going back to work? No one asked any of these incredibly accomplished women around the table when they were going back to work.
Absolutely. Or there's an assumption, you know, when the husband's doing the grocery shopping and the checkout, you know, with the kids, and the checkout chick says, oh, that, you know, great that Dad's got the day off today, or aren't you good shopping with the children? You know, and we go, well...
Yeah, it's like no one gives us an award for baking a cake for the cake sale, but the minute the father does.
But we need to challenge those. We need to challenge those comments.
Yeah, it's the other end of the bias.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Juliet? This is your field.
Yeah, I'm really vexed on this one. I was really hardcore against quotas. And then when I was up in Singapore last week, it was a conference of Asian women leaders, and one of the questions came up was about quotas. And I had done an analysis of the movements that countries had made towards parity just by sort of doing voluntary exercise. So we had in Australia in 2010, if not, why not, which was basically a policy position. Every organisation had to disclose if they hadn't done a move around gender diversity in particular. If not, why not? Why wouldn't you do? Then we've had sort of increases in public pressure around with the male champions of change. And we've done lots of different things, and now governments have come out with their 50% quotas. And then I compared it all the way down to China, which has done absolutely nothing and has 6.2% women on boards, and we're at 25%, and all the countries in between. So like your epiphany around Norway, when I looked at that, it seemed to me if you don't put tension into the system, it never moves. And I think we are moving towards quotas, and I'm starting to become softer on the inside because I've been in this space for a long time and I'm not seeing an accelerated movement. And the latest predictions from the UN are that it will take more than 100 years to get to parity. So I'm softening.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think at a conference I said that I would be 216 according to when the UN thinks we're going to have parity.
Yeah.
What do you think, Renee?
I think quotas work. My experience with them was I used to work at the ANZ Bank. I worked in the corporate social responsibility team there. We set up a range of targets around different programs in the responsibility, social responsibility space, including women in leadership positions, and they have made, you know, I've since left, and they continue to make significant progress. And I think if there are targets in place, they're measured, actions are, you know, committed in terms of how they're going to achieve it, and that's the only way we're going to do this. And we've seen it with the Victorian government recently, who committed to 50% of women on government boards, and they've achieved that in a really quick amount of time. So I'm absolutely 100% for quotas.
Richard?
Yeah, I'm a big advocate of targets. So, you know, firm, measurable, public targets that are communicated and shared. I'm in two minds about the issue of targets, but I think if the corporate community doesn't, you know, embrace targets and, you know, disclose progress against them, then I see no other option.
As in mandated.
As in mandated. Mm. I mean, my general bias is against mandates. You know, any regulation always has unintended consequences and often very severe. But at a minimum, I think there should be a requirement that every company has a policy that is disclosed and that progress against that is measured.
Everyone, I'm sure you'll agree this has been a wicked session. Can I ask you all to join me in thanking Julia, Juliet, Renee and Richard. And I'll just get you to... let me just give you some brief housekeeping before I bid you farewell. Remember to fill in your presenter feedback for this plenary session via the Actuaries Institute app or the Summit microsite. I'm going to be saying that to you after and before every session. Don't forget to visit the Institute booth to read electronic copies of the synopses and papers whilst charging your phone. And as you know, the gala dinner is tonight, so please meet in the hotel lobby to walk to Melbourne Town Hall at 6:50 p.m. tonight. And if you've registered for the airport bus departing at 5:15 tomorrow, please be sure to cancel your seat at the registration desk if you no longer plan to travel on the bus. In the morning, suitcases can be stored on this level, level 8, and just around the corner, the Institute staff will be here to direct you. After the conclusion of Concurrent 1, lunch will be served in the residence, which is the same venue as last night's cocktail party, if you can remember that, and downstairs in Colin's kitchen. I encourage you again to visit the Andara icon on the app or the Andara email in your inbox and donate. That, I'm sure you'll agree, was a very inspiring talk by Audette Excel, and if you can help, I'm sure she will be so grateful. I'll see you back here this afternoon at 4:30 for the third plenary on thinking differently about customers. In the meantime, enjoy your lunch. Thank you very much.